Welcome to the Sandwell News for the blind and visually impaired community living in and near Sandwell. This edition is for the 21st of February, available by post on the internet and as a podcast split into chapters for those who can listen on their smartphones or special devices.
As we enter the last week of February, sunrise will be at 7:05. Sunset at 5:40. It will be somewhat warmer with temperatures at around 5 degrees Celsius, but it will be quite windy.
Before we get to the news from the papers, here are some of the activities being run by SVI this coming week.
Calling all SVI members, friends and volunteers. Here is the list of activities taking place next week. Tuesday, 24th February. Gym at Portway Lifestyle Centre, 10 to 12 noon. Break a sweat and boost your energy with fellow SVI members. From treadmills and bikes to weights, there's something for everyone, and plenty of support to help you along the way. It's a fun, social way to stay fit and active all year round, rain or shine. Line dancing at Dartmouth Central Club, 1 to 2:30 p.m. Put on your dancing shoes and join Ray and Jean for a lively line dancing session full of fun and feel-good moves. Whether you're looking to stay active, improve your balance, or simply meet new people, this is the perfect chance. Absolute beginners are welcome, just come along and enjoy. We'd love to see you on the dance floor. Wednesday, 25th February. Brunch at the Interceptor, Hungry Horse, New Square, West Bromwich. 10:30 a.m. After the success of our January lunch, this relaxed brunch get-together is easy to reach by public transport and right in the heart of the shopping centre. You might want to browse the shops afterwards. Please let us know if you're coming so we can book tables. Food and drink can be ordered and paid for on the day. Showdown at Portway Lifestyle Centre, 1 to 3 p.m. Come and join us for this fast-moving, interactive sports similar to table tennis and air hockey. Designed for blind and visually impaired people, but anyone can play. It is important that you contact the office either by phone, message, Facebook or email to let us know that you are attending any of our events. That's all for this week. We look forward to seeing you soon. Kind regards, the SVI team, Sandwell, visually impaired, West Bromwich Town Hall, Lodge Road, West Bromwich B 708 AY, telephone 01215254810, website sandwellvisuallyimpaired.org.uk.
Some headlines from this week's readings from the Express and Star. Wednesday, the 11th of February news. Albion versus Birmingham. Reform Party rally. Mobile phones at schools. On this day. Thursday. Lloyds Bank to close 9 branches. Albion debrief. Aldi's new chicken nugget taster. Green burials. Friday. Acting fast to keep our streets safe. Faulty Towers show is pure nostalgia. 3 in hospital after Bearwood Street disorder. Search for a new Baggies technical director. Saturday. Tale of a Good Samaritan. NSPCC fears some parents drinking too much. Poundland founder moves into a semi for TV series. Fear of losing open spaces. Monday. 2 guns and ammunition seized. World Hearing Day and Sounds of the City. Ramsey. Albion's brighter future. Tuesday. Woman's assistance dog aiming for a Crufts prize. Police objection to reopening of a West Bromwich pub. The pressures of studying for school exams.
Those stories and more coming up with kind permission of Express and Star Publications. Now, I must offer an apology for getting the quiz wrong a couple of weeks ago. I provided the wrong answers. So Sarah Ann is back with a quiz you'll have heard before, but this time with the right answers. And I feel I owe a bit of an apology to anybody who uses the Metro tram service. There was a lot of disruption on the 2 days from Tuesday until Thursday of the week while I'm recording. That is up until the 18th of February or the 19th of February. I know this because we waited to get on a tram in the centre of Birmingham and there weren't any. And we really should have had news about that, because that's quite an important disruption. All to do with the line that's going off from Wednesbury towards Dudley, and that to close the line so they could link up the main Wolverhampton line with the new extension. So I'll try and get on to Travel West Midlands or whoever runs the transport information service in this area to see if they can let us know of important disruptions on the trams and of course on the buses for that matter, because quite a few of our listeners do use public transport. Apart from all that, other things coming up are the usual radio and TV listings from Talking News Federation, and we might have one or two more pieces from them as well. I don't think there's any Albion news this week because of the FA Cup matches, but we'll get straight on now with the news from Wednesday.
Hi everyone, it's Mia. Today I'm going to be reading some newspaper articles from Wednesday the 11th of February. I hope everyone's having a really great weekend. As I'm recording this, it's actually Valentine's Day, so if anyone has any plans, I hope you have a lovely day. And if you don't, regardless, I still hope you have a lovely rest of your weekend. Let's begin. Battling baggies put bodies on the line to deny Blues. Albion claimed a precious point with a dodge display to deny Birmingham in their West Midlands derby clash, as Blues had a last-gasp strike ruled out for offside. The baggies were forced into some last-ditch defending and goal-line clearances as in-form Blues piled on the pressure in their hunt for a Championship playoff place. But Albion's defence held firm for a goalless draw as they claim what could prove a crucial A point in their fight against relegation. Goalkeeper Max O'Leary clawed one effort off the line in the first half, after the ball looked to have struck the arm of defender Callum Stiles in the 6-yard box. And defender Charlie Taylor also made a goal line clearance midway through the second half before August Prisk thought he had won it for Blues, only for the flag to go up for an offside against Damara Gray. The result saw Albion moved up a place into 19th. Earlier, Albion fans suffered a rainy wait at St Andrews. Fan coaches took longer than usual to arrive due to congestion, and when they arrived, turnstiles were not working correctly, leaving some fans unable to get into the ground until the problem was rectified. Jeremy Kyle hosts as Farage rallies troops. Reform leader joined by long line former Tories at NEC. One thing's for certain, we live in a fast-moving political climate. Even so, when I started work on Monday morning, I did not expect to find myself sitting on Reform UK's front bench by mid-afternoon. Turned out, the security man had misdirected me, and instead of taking my place in the relative anonymity of the media scrum, I accidentally found myself sitting in a seat reserved for Lee Anderson. Or was it Robert Jenrick? Not sure. All seemed a bit of a blur. Fortunately, one of the Reform UK top brass spotted the error and redirected me before I ended up running the Foreign Office or something. But this was just the start of an afternoon which was going to take a lot of unexpected turns. For example, when I arrived at Reform's winter conference at the NEC, I never expected to find myself watching Jeremy Kyle questioning Richard Tice about his impending wedding arrangements. It was one of those afternoons when you just have to go with the flow and see where it takes you. By this time, the media area was looking pretty packed, so I took a seat behind the stage next to a middle-aged blonde lady sporting a striking array of tattoos. A couple of older men were sat the other side of me, politely muttering in agreement as Kyle fronted the mother-of-all warm-up acts, building up the tension to the main man, as Kyle repeatedly referred to him. The former BRMB DJ invited each of the party's 8 MPs to join him in a chat show-style set, where they were invited to explain the story that had led to them preparing the crowd for Nigel Farage's great set-piece address. The tattooed lady jumped to her feet and let out a huge whoop of delight as Jeremy Carl introduced Andrew Rosendale to the conference. Now there's another sentence I never expected to find myself writing, and the crowd sat enthralled by a man they'd probably never heard of a few months ago, describing how he now felt like a bird that had been released from its cage. Lee Anderson had the crowd in stitches when he described the Deputy Prime Minister as Calamity Lammy. Kyle pointed out that Angela Rayner had recently undergone a makeover. "She's throwing her money away," quipped Lee Boy to yet more hysterics. Anderson reckoned there were 2,000 people in the arena. The Tories couldn't get that many in over a whole week, and the figures sounded about right. He told the cheering throng that 70% of Reform members had never been involved with politics before. There was certainly a very different demographic to the last party conference I attended, when Robert Jenrick was putting his case for the Tory party leadership. Not that many suits, but a fair few turquoise t-shirts and the odd dandy in a dicky bow, plus a couple of Essex girls draped in the Union Jack. I could tell they were Essex girls because it said it on one of their capes. It almost felt like being at a non-league football match, although the crowd refrained from questioning the compere's parentage. Robert Jenrick got in the customary name check for his hometown. I joined the Conservative Party in 1997 as a 16-year-old in Wolverhampton. There weren't many 16-year-old Conservatives in Wolverhampton back then. To roars of laughter, and Sarah Pochin wowed the crowds with tales of how prison officers had been replaced by Nigerians who needed cards to tell inmates to get back into their cells. By the time Suella Braverman started berating Tory lies, it was hard to know what the great leader could do to top the applause. And then the main man took to the podium, only to be enveloped in a jet of smoke, in a show of pyrotechnics that would have seemed a little over the top at Robbie Williams' concert at the Civic. You've got to hand it to the Reform boys and girls. They know how to put on a good show. Nigel thundered how Britain was broken, how DEI would be a thing of the past when he was in Downing Street, how net zero targets would be scrapped, nuclear power turbocharged, and the North Sea drilled until 2050. "Don't let them say we will privatise the NHS," he bellowed. "Not while Labour are outsourcing the NHS, and you can have a Zoom consultation with a doctor on a beach in Barbados." He berated Reform lead Worcestershire County Council as a basket case after it announced plans for a 10% increase in council tax, pointing out that the party did not have outright control. Rachel Reeves was described as the most useless Prime Minister in British history, a promotion which must surely have come as news to Sir Keir Starmer. A slip of the tongue maybe, but you can imagine the hubbub if the real Prime Minister, or Kemi Badenoch, had made it. It's certainly true that the people who had turned out of Reform's winter conference got their money's worth, and the atmosphere was certainly upbeat. But, as Boris Johnson found out, there is more to governing the country than fun, and only time will tell whether Nigel Farage and his people's armies has really broken the mould of two-party politics. To round it off, the man touted to be in Downing Street before too long ended his performance by firing Reform UK t-shirts into the crowd. Something else I didn't expect to be writing when I started work today. And then to explain the picture that we have on the newspaper article, it's just of Nigel Farage walking onto the stage in that cloud of smoke that Mark Andrews, the writer of this article, described, and he's kind of chuckling to himself as he walks on for the rally. Little difference in well-being with school phone policies. Study recommends new ways of approaching mobile use for adolescents. Restrictive school phone policies are not linked to better student mental well-being, a study has found. And managing phone use can take schools more than 100 hours a week. Researchers at the University of Birmingham found no significant difference in measures like worry, sadness and optimism for year 8 and year 10 students at secondary schools with more lax versus more restrictive mobile phone rules. It comes after the government updated guidance on phone use in schools to emphasise they should not be used. and announced it would launch a consultation on an Australian-style social media ban for under-16s. The study involved 20 secondary students matched across key characteristics, 13 with restrictive phone policies and 7 with more permissive policies. Schools classified as having more permissive policies were those where phones were allowed at break times, for example, while restrictive schools were those that did not allow phone use for the entire school day or even on the premises. Schools with more restrictive rules reported they spent an average of 102 hours a week implementing them and applying behaviour sanctions if they were violated. However, schools with more permissive rules still reported spending an average of 108 hours on managing phone use, like more time spent on things like administering policies and recording incidents related to phones. Researchers said the findings show new ways to manage phones in schools are needed. University of Birmingham's Professor Victoria Goodyear, chief investigator of the Smart School study, said, "School phone policies, whether permissive or restrictive, are a huge drain on a school to enforce. We need new ways of approaching adolescent smartphone use in schools." Main route closing for 6 weeks in a £1.5 million works. The main shopping road in a Black Country town centre will close for 6 weeks to allow for a £1.5 million regeneration project. Owen Street in Tipton will close completely for 6 weeks beginning on Monday, reopening on March 27th. When it reopens, a 20 mph speed limit will be imposed along Owen Street, which also serves as the main route to Tipton Railway Station. The work has been welcomed by Tipton and Wednesbury MP Antonia Bance, who hailed it as exciting news. "At the end of all the works in July, Owen Street will look much smarter," she said. The shopfronts opposite the centre on Owen Street will be upgraded in the coming months too, and there will be new planters, trees, seating, lights and signs in the town centre. This is all part of the regeneration plans for Central Tipton, a £1.5 million investment alongside building 70 new council flats for local people to the rear of the shopping centre on Union Street. A spokesman for Sandwell Council said the works represented a key milestone in a wider plan to regenerate Tipton town centre. He said the project would transform Owen Street into a safer, more attractive and more pedestrian-friendly route through the town centre. The works will include new street lighting, resurfaced pavements, tree planting and landscaping along Owen Street and the shopping precinct. Town centre businesses will remain open as usual throughout the works, and the council has encouraged residents to continue supporting local shops and traders. Access to homes and businesses will be maintained at all times, despite road closures. Works are being carried out by the council's appointed contractor, McPhillips, and are scheduled to run from Monday the 16th of February 2026 until July 2026. As part of the programme, Cadent Gas will also carry out planned works from February 16th to March 13th. A council spokesman said disruption would be minimised by carrying out as much regeneration work as possible while the road was already closed. Closure will operate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with ongoing updates provided to residents and businesses, he said.
On this day, February 11th, 1765, English wig makers petitioned George III for financial relief as the male fashion of wearing wigs came to an end. 1810, French Emperor Napoleon married Marie-Louise of Austria, having rejected Josephine because of her inability to fill the royal nursery. 1847, inventor Thomas Edison was born in Ohio. 1852, the first flushing lavatory for women opened in Bedford Street, London. 1858, the miracle of Lourdes took place when St. Bernadette, peasant girl Bernadette Soulburus, and her first vision of the Virgin Mary. 1929. The 109 acres of the Vatican in Rome was made an independent sovereign state under the Lateran Treaty. 1940. John Buchan, Scottish novelist who became Lord Tweedsmuir, died. He is best remembered for his creation, Richard Hannay, and the novel The 39 Steps. 1975. Margaret Thatcher became the first woman leader of a British political party, the Conservatives, at the age of 49. 1990. South Africa's black nationalist leader Nelson Mandela was freed from prison after 27 years. 2012. American rhythm and blues singer Whitney Houston, who emerged as a pop superstar in the 1980s, especially known for her soaring voice, died at 48. 2010. The fashion world mourned the loss of a modern-day genius following the death of Alexander McQueen. On this day, last year, Chelsea striker Sam Kerr was found not guilty of racially aggravated harassment for calling a Metropolitan Police officer stupid and white.
Hello, this is Jan Lloyd, reading articles from the Express and Star on the 12th of February. Lloyd's to close 9 branches, by Beverly Rudmacher. Lloyd's Banking Group is to close 9 branches across the West Midlands, affecting customers of Lloyd's Bank, Halifax and Bank of Scotland. The banking group is shutting 53 Lloyd's branches, 31 Halifax and 11 Bank of Scotland sites across the UK as part of the latest announcement. And it will have a big impact on communities across the Black Country, Staffordshire and Birmingham, who will lose their bank. All the closures will take place between May 2026 and March 2027. The Lloyd's branch in King Swynford will close on June the 22nd. The Tetnall branch in Wolverhampton will close on June the 11th and Uttoxeter on June the 18th. The Lloyd's branch in Wensbury is set to close on March the 16th but may be replaced by a banking hub to serve all banks. Halifax, which is part of Lloyd's Banking Group, will close its branch in Hales Owen on June the 17th. 4 branches will close in Blackheath, Bordesley Green, King Standing and Maypole. Cash Access Network Link said, banking hubs will protect access to cash where they are set up. The hubs are shared spaces operated by staff at different banks on different days, offering services including withdrawing and depositing cash and paying bills. Lloyd's did not specify how many members of staff will be impacted by the closures, but all of those who work at the branches will be offered a role at another branch or in another part of the business. A spokeswoman said the changes are part of steps to offer more choice and ways to manage money than ever before. It is the latest swathe of branches to be axed, with Lloyd's in the middle of its latest round of closures, which will see 49 sites shut down by October. That followed 136 closures announced around a year ago. It will have 610 branches remaining after the closures. Before I read this, I'd like to apologise for any mispronunciations, as I'm afraid I'm not very up with the Albion's players and their names. So I apologise for anything before we start. Debrief. It may be ugly, but it is what Albion need. Blues nil, Albion nil, by John Drury. Albion picked up what could be another key point come the end of the season, as they kept Birmingham City at bay on Tuesday evening. Chances were limited for the Baggies, and they had to soak up waves of pressure, but they got over the line with a bit of fortune late in the game. Blues had the ball in the net before it was ruled out off for offside, before Vicente struck the post with the last kick of the game. It was a second clean sheet and was given Albion a platform to kick on from in the coming weeks. Here are some of the key points to come out of the game. Damning statistics, but a change. Tuesday night represented Albion's first back-to-back clean sheets since 2024. It was also the first time they had gone unbeaten in 2 games since November. Those statistics outline how bad Albion have been this season and how open they have been since the end of the Carlos Corberan days. You need to score goals to win games, but you need to keep them out if you're to build momentum. They have found a way now, Eric Ramsay may have gone the long way around finding it, but his back four has given Albion a platform. Accepting the ugly. Ramsay accepted it. Albion are having to play ugly at the moment, and the fans are accepting of it too. These are Albion fans who have sat through Megson football and Pulis football. They can accept ugly football if the players are giving it their all. In the last two games, they have been seeing that, and if they can marry that up with the odd goal, they should be okay. Too nice? More dark arts. Albion are a side that for too long have been too nice. They have no nasty characters, but on Tuesday, we saw Albion using some of the dark arts that need to be used when you are in a relegation dogfight. Ramsay admitted he needs to see more of it and that it is what they need to do, and some don't like it, but everyone else does it, so Albion need to do it too. Key Championship duo. Ramsay didn't have the luxury of Alex Mowat and Jason Mullumby in the first few weeks of his time in charge. They have been keen to Albion for some time, offer balance and complement each other. Mullumby's energy is offset with Mowat's calming influence and quality in possession. They give Albion so much balance, and as much as Ousmane Diakite has his value, the other duo need to play. When they do, the Baggies are a much better side. Now for the goals. Chances haven't been coming by the bucket load, but Albion have shown just enough to give a bit of optimism that the goals will flow. Ayuni Hegabo returned on Tuesday and his hold-up play was superb, but he needs service. Their confidence is low, but when that comes back, the goals will come. It feels like it will just be a matter of time. And the article's accompanied by three pictures of the game on the other night with a picture of Max O'Leary clearing a corner as the Baggies kept the Blues at bay on Tuesday, and also a picture of Alex Mowat shooting for goal and Isaac Price heading the ball. Albion wearing their yellow and green away kit. Man arrested over BB gun. An 18-year-old man was arrested following the discovery of an imitation firearm during a stop and search in West Bromwich. Officers from Operation Guardian stopped a group of men acting suspiciously on New Street on Tuesday evening. During a search, a BB gun was recovered. The 18-year-old man from Birmingham was arrested on suspicion of possession of an imitation firearm in a public place, and he remains in police custody for questioning. Nugget boy Rory gets hands on dream job as official taster. A Wolves fan who went viral after having a chicken nugget stolen by his dad at Molyneux has landed a dream role at Aldi's official chicken nugget taster. Four-year-old Rory Smith from Tiverdale has turned the tearful viral moment into a dream job after the clip, which captured the young fan's heartbroken reaction at his dad's cheeky nugget steal, quickly spread across social media. The moment was caught on camera during a Wolves 0-0 draw against Newcastle United and drew amused reactions across social media. Just days before Rory's viral moment, Aldi launched a nationwide search for its first ever nugget taster, celebrating the nation's love of the crispy classic, with over 164 million chicken nuggets flying off the shelves in the past year alone. When the supermarket spotted Rory's video, they knew they had found the perfect fit and immediately offered him a special mini nugget tasting role. Rory, who also lives with Mum Claire and sister Fern, aged 8, will help to taste test Aldi's much-loved chicken nugget range and give his thumbs up on his favourite product. And the picture accompanies a lovely picture of Rory in his Wolves kit, standing with his hands wide open on facing a table full of chicken nuggets and sauce, ready for him to have a little taste test. He looks very thrilled at the thought as well. Back to nature for final resting place. Many people are opting to go back to nature by selecting a green burial for when they die. The definition of a green burial is a little non-specific, but is generally a burial that takes place outside of a traditional cemetery or churchyard, said Director of Isca Funeral Service Limited, Michael Hull. Green burials can be in a woodland or a wildflower meadow setting. They promote the use of natural materials such as biodegradable coffins or shrouds, often made locally, and the sites are managed to encourage wildflowers and native trees as well as an abundance of wildlife. Be aware that the sites often have very rustic look with long grass and may even have stinging nettles. Typically, headstones would not be permitted, but some sites allow a flat stone plaque set into the ground. A natural burial ground will often have a structure where a ceremony can be held at the time of the funeral, and this structure may be of natural construction. Usually, embalming, which is a chemical treatment of the deceased, is prohibited. Who has one? Many people from all walks of life opt for a green burial. They are especially suitable for people who like all things natural and to whom a rustic setting far from the ordered structure of a cemetery would have a greater appeal, says Michael. The services are often led by a celebrant or family member and are without the more traditional prayers and hymns of a traditional service. Having said this, many natural burial grounds also welcome a minister to lead a religious service. Key benefits. There are many benefits to a natural burial, said Michael. Often the burial site will only hold one service each day, as such there is no time pressure. A green burial can be very personal to the person who has died. Families may like to be actively involved in reading tributes, poems, singing songs or playing music, whatever would help the family to have a personal goodbye. Unlike cremation, a burial gives a physical place where loved ones can go to be with their loved ones. But remember, if you're opting for a green burial place, it is likely to be rustic without smooth, paved paths. Why are they popular? Funerals are changing and many people are now opting for non-religious services without the pomp of a black hearse followed by a limousine going to a service led by a minister who has never met the deceased, said Michael. Green burials as well as cremation now give people the option to tailor the service to reflect the person who has died. People are now aware that a funeral can be more individual and bespoke, and because of this, more people are now opting for green burials. Price and costing. The cost of a green burial can be very competitive when compared to cemetery burials and even cremations, which have been perceived as cheaper than burials, said Michael. The cost will, of course, vary depending on your requirements, but this can be very thrifty if needed, with families leading a service followed by a picnic for the people gathered, or you can push the boat out with live music, bands and outside caterers. The control of the cost should be in your hands. Finding out more. You can find out more about natural burial grounds from the Natural Death Centre, www.naturaldeath.org.uk, or the Good Funeral Guide, www.goodfuneralguide.com. The photograph accompanying the article is of a quite thickly grown woodland with a beautiful canopy of trees, really, and wooded paths underneath.
Hello, it's Rachel here, and I've got some readings for you from the 13th of February. No excuses. We are acting fast on knives to stop violence and keep our streets safe. By Daniel Walton. A minister today spoke of her determination to tackle the causes of knife crime that has led to the loss of young lives in the West Midlands. Minister of State for Policing and Crime, Sarah Jones, said new mandatory specialised plans will specifically target youths carrying blades and have a real impact in reducing violence. It comes following several deaths involving young people and knives across the West Midlands. And as a 15-year-old killer who murdered Leo Ross in a random knife attack in Birmingham was named as Kian Moulton. The new plans will see every child caught carrying a knife in England and Wales given a mandatory targeted plan to sway them from reoffending in the future. They will be immediately referred to the Youth Justice Service. Speaking to the Express and Star, she said, "In previous years, I believe around 1,000 kids a year were found in possession of a knife and had no consequences whatsoever in terms of interventions. So we are scrapping that. It's wrong. It cannot be right that you could have a child who is caught in possession of a knife and there is not a package of diversionary interventions that goes alongside whatever conviction or caution is given. Youth crime must be tackled. No excuses." Ms. Jones praised the work of Pooja Kanda, who has campaigned for change after her 16-year-old son Ronan was killed in Wolverhampton. She said Ms. Kanda's efforts had prompted the government to act decisively on the issue, adding, "She has pushed me and the Prime Minister and me to go further and faster on knife crime with an extraordinary effort. The Knife Crime Coalition has a range of people on it who bring expertise, Ms. Pooja especially. Ms. Pooja said, "This is a great initiative from the government and is exactly what we need, a proper plan. We must not let youths who are caught with a knife be left isolated with no support and crying out for help. I believe this plan would have stopped my son's attacker from reoffending and eventually taking my son's life. We must guide young people away from using knives. I am fully behind this initiative and the government's overall mission to halve knife crime in a decade." Along with the article are two photographs. The first is of Pooja Kanda. The second is of a police officer and policing minister, Sarah Jones. Fawlty Towers show is pure nostalgic comedy at its best. Famous hotel with crazy characters opens for business on stage of City Theatre. Review of Fawlty Towers by Alison Norton at Grand Theatre. When Torquay Hotel Fawlty Towers opened its doors on the BBC for the first time in 1975, it was hailed as a new and exciting form of comedy and soon proved to be a highly successful hit. Just over 50 years on, and Basil, Sybil and a cast of crazy characters are treading the boards at the Wolverhampton Grand Theatre until February 21st, offering wonderfully nostalgic and what today would be considered to be slightly inappropriate laugh-out-loud moments galore. From the quality of the script, it is obvious that the play has been written by John Cleese and Connie Booth and really is the very best example of a stage adaptation. Comprising of the best moments from three of the 12 episodes written, yes, only 12, I thought there were much more too, plus some extra hilarious antics thrown in for good measure, this is 2 hours of pure mirth. The scenery is an absolute replica of the TV set, so much so that you feel as if you have been transported inside the hotel itself. The lighting effects are sharp and precise, the costumes completely authentic of the era and again perfect replicas of the originals. This is exactly what audience members want. There is no need to modernise this. It is a classic comedy and should remain as it was first presented. Caroline J. Ranger's direction is sublime, slick and clear and concise amid the scenes where mayhem ensues, which enables the audience to follow the plot without any problem at all. The key to the success of this comedy, though, is without doubt the casting, which is a triumph. It cannot have been easy to find an actor who could take on the very unique role of Basil Fawlty. But Danny Bain is idyllic. His ability to mimic Basil's physical comedy, his delivery of killer lines, and his chemistry with the rest of the cast is exceptional. Mia Austin, who takes the role of his feisty, fire-breathing wife Sybil, is also outstanding. While she is the voice of reason and the ultimate professional in front of the guests, her continual marital war with Basil rages on, resulting in some of the best lines and funniest moments in the play. Hemi Yarraham takes the role of the long-suffering Spanish waiter Manuel and again gives a comedy performance worthy of an award. Strictly star Joanne Clifton as Polly is cool, calm and collected and probably the only sane person in the hotel. The rest of the cast take on a variety of colourful characters who perfectly frame the mayhem and madness which make the play so unique. Fawlty Towers is pure nostalgic comedy at its very best. For tickets, visit grandtheatre.co.uk or call 01902 429 212. Along with the article are two photographs. The first has the caption, "The cast of John Cleese's stage adaptation of Fawlty Towers, photo by Hugo Glendinning." And it shows the cast all on stage, mid-action. The second has the caption, "Danny Bain as Basil Fawlty," and shows Bain dressed up as Basil, acting on the stage. Three men in hospital following disorder. An appeal has been launched for witnesses and footage following a disorder incident in Bearwood, which left three men in hospital. West Midlands Police said it had launched the appeal after being alerted to reports of a group fighting with weapons on Bearwood Road on Wednesday evening, with three men taken to hospital, having also been arrested on suspicion of wounding. The force said another man had remained in custody for questioning on suspicion of wounding, and the road had been closed for initial investigations before being reopened. It has asked for anyone with any information to get in touch. A spokesman for West Midlands Police said, "We are appealing for witnesses and footage as we continue to investigate disorder in Bearwood. We were alerted to a group fighting with weapons on Bearwood Road at just before 6 p.m. Three men are currently in hospital, one with potentially serious injuries, following the disorder. The men, aged between 19 and 30, have been arrested on suspicion of wounding. They will be questioned when medically fit. Another man, aged 42, has also been detained on suspicion of wounding and is currently in custody for questioning. The road was closed during initial investigations, but has since reopened. We're currently assessing CCTV we've recovered, but we know there were a number of people in the area at the time, and we're keen to hear from anybody with information or mobile phone footage. We're particularly interested in any dashcam footage from motorists who were driving through the area." Baggies Target Price Quits Role by Russell Yule. Albion have taken a big step forward in their search for a new technical director after it emerged top candidate Dominic Price has left his position at Israeli champions Maccabi Tel Aviv. The former Liverpool analyst has been at the top of the Hawthorns' wanted list for the position, which is seen as a key role in building the future of the club. Price spent the last 2.5 years with Maccabi as their technical director. It is understood Albion are on track with their appointment plans, and it is hoped that an announcement is made for the role in the next few weeks. Prior to moving to Israel, Price, 35, was a highly regarded analyst at Liverpool, where he spent more than a decade. The Baggies have been on the hunt for a new technical director for a number of months, a move that was revealed by a former club president and sporting director, Andrew Nestor, who left his role last week. The appointment of a new technical director is not a replacement for the axed next Nestor. Albion, under chairman and owner Shilan Patel, have been aiming to reshape those in charge of the sporting department. Nestor previously said on appointing a technical director, "The evolution of our sporting department also includes a process that began in September 2025 to recruit a technical director. It is a newly formed role within the club who will work alongside sporting leadership, focusing on further evolution of the club's game mode, squad planning, balance and academy operations, and player pathways and technology and analysis innovation."
Hello everyone, this is Linda, reading from Saturday the 14th of February's Express and Star.
Good Samaritan keeping spirit of compassion alive. I'm going to begin this week with a thank you to the White Knight who helped me out on Wednesday night while dealing with a type of middling motoring hiccups that we all detest, especially at the end of a working day when you just want to get home. I was given the aid of a second pair of hands by a passing stranger. Said young chap, only 21, pulled over after spotting my predicament and actually bothering to do an about turn to check if I was okay and whether or not he could be of assistance. Between the two of us, we got the job done easily, and I was soon on my way back to Morris Manor and a cold bevy. I thanked him profusely for his help and was very humbled when he simply said, "Well, if we all helped each other, it'd be better, wouldn't it?" He was dead right. And it was especially lovely to hear this from a lad in his early 20s. When I was that age, I was certainly far less concerned with the well-being of strangers than this chap, and he stood before as a great example of Gen Z, often given a bad rap, and of society in general. If only there had been a similar tale written a couple of thousand years ago that we could all have learned from, eh? but at least the spirit of the Good Samaritan is alive in some, and in the young to boot. The next time I hear the youth of today suffering their usual generalised tongue-lashing from the curmudgeons of the world, I'll be straight to their defence. I've spoken before about one of the greatest shames of the cynical modern world we often live in is people's reluctance, or at least weariness, to help others in the way they might naturally have done more in days gone by. Sadly, this day and age is filled with stories of danger and of people being taken advantage of when either seeking help from those they don't know or offering to give it. Unfortunately, this has built up an often understandable barrier in people's minds when it comes to giving anyone else a chuck. With this, though, I'm happy to report a similar story of kindness that occurred earlier this week, involving my dear dad and a young woman in something of a plight. Said young lady was reportedly in some distress at a petrol station, en route to a job interview, but struggling to find her way to her destination. In appealing to the locals gathered near the fuel pumps, she herself was from out of the region, she garnered the help of my father, who gave her the directions she needed. She was only a stone's throw from where her interview would be taking place, but with time ticking on, she was still in something of a panic. With her anxiety visible, yet very easily quashed, my dad went one further and offered to actually give her a lift to where she needed to be. With gleeful thanks, she accepted, was dropped off in good time, and therefore probably stood a much better chance of getting the job in question than if she turned up in a justifiable flap. This was just a simple, happy case of one human being helping another, and the other being grateful for it. Yet sadly, society's advice to both of them, a pensioner and a youngster, both vulnerable in their own way, would probably have been to not have put themselves in that situation. Unfortunately, aforementioned horror stories have made this advice often sensible. But it is really nice to hear tales of people simply going with their gut in trying to be kind, and this being well received with a good result being achieved. Amongst the gloom and doom that often is the news, simple stories of casual compassion are a wonderful welcome thing in 2026, and with the year having only just begun, I hope we hear a lot more of them. It is always very important to be vigilant and careful, but with safety in mind, it is wonderful to both give help and to accept it from your fellow man as well. Humans are pack animals, and if we all give each other a lift every now and again, the pack becomes bigger and stronger. My old man has always said, "A stranger is a friend I haven't met yet." It's really nice when such sentiments, often dismissed as naive, can be proved true and assure us that the world hasn't completely gone to pot just yet. Maybe, just maybe, there is hope for us all as we move ever closer to a new decade of excitement, yet also uncertainty and sometimes panic. With so much of the world we know changing, we need to look after each other as best we can. Ultimately, we are all we've got. And that's an article by Dan Morris.
Fears for children due to parental alcohol misuse. Thousands of children in the West Midlands are living with the impact of parental alcohol misuse, new figures reveal, as charities warn families they do not have to suffer in silence. Data released by the NSPCC shows that 7,330 children in the region were identified as having a parent who misused alcohol between April 2024 and March 2025, while subject to a Child in Need assessment in England, making it fifth place in the national figures. Nationally, the total figure stood at 73,250 over the same period. The NSPCC helpline received 9,192 contacts from across the UK, an average of 25 a day, from people worried about a parent or carer's drug or alcohol use. Callers reported hearing violent arguments and furniture being thrown, seeing parents inebriated or collapsed, and concerns about children appearing dirty and neglected. Regular drug and alcohol misuse by parents or carers can create chaotic home environments, where children's needs are not properly recognised or met, increasing the risk of harm. While it does not always result in abuse or neglect, it can seriously affect a child's emotional well-being. The NSPCC has released the figures to mark National Association for Children of Alcoholics, NACOA, UK's Children of Alcoholics Week, 8th to the 14th of February, urging children in the West Midlands and beyond who are affected by substance misuse at home to seek help. The charity also stressed that support is available for parents concerned about the impact of their own or another adult's substance use on a child. Childline offers free, confidential support for young people, 24 hours a day on 0800 1111. NACOA UK also runs a helpline for anyone affected by a parent's drinking, available on 0800 358 3456 or via helpline at nacoa.org.uk. Millionaire Poundland founder swaps his mansion for a semi. Appearing on the show was an experience and good to see how the other half live. The backcountry entrepreneur who founded Poundland took a trip down memory lane as he featured on TV's Rich House, Poor House, with the episode set to air tomorrow. Multimillionaire Steve Smith, who made his fortune from the once-booming budget chain renowned for selling all products for £1, is appearing on the Channel 5 reality show with his son Joe. The pair swapped lives with the struggling Deeming Thomas family of seven from Stafford and had to survive on a £38 budget for a week. Filming for the show took former market stallholder Steve back to Bilston Market, where it all began for him and his late dad Keith, who founded Poundland together with fellow market trader Dave Dodd. He told the Express and Star he enjoyed revisiting his Black Country roots for the show and sharing the experience with Joe, aged 30. Steve and his dad originally sold items for 10p in a box on Bilston Market, and the concept proved successful. So they set up an office above Sedgley's Concord Market and opened their first store in Burton-on-Trent on December the 13th, 1990, turning over £13,000 in one day. "It makes you remember where you came from," he said after revisiting the market. The Wolverhampton-born entrepreneur swapped his 200-acre estate, Ludstone Hall in Claverley, one of the country's finest Jacobean mansions, with a moat and parkland, for the Deeming Thomas's family's modest 3/4-bedroom semi-detached housing association home, which accommodates Dad, John, 40, and Mum, Kelly, 41, both plasterers, and their five children, Marley, 20, Kamara, 16, Rekia, 14, Dre, 13 and Amari, 10. Steve, aged 63, who lived in Willenhall for some time before the Poundland Empire made him wealthy, said, "It was a great experience for us. We lived their lives for a week. We spent about £12 on groceries and we managed it. They had about £2,000 a week to spend." Although working as plasterers, the Deeming Thomases did not have a van or advertise and had been struggling to make ends meet. Since the show was filmed, however, generous Steve, who sold Poundland for £250 million in 2006, said he's bought them a van and given them quite a bit of work, and he added, "We've kept them busy. We're helping them turn their lives around." The couple, who have been together for 24 years, said the experience of going on the show and meeting Steve had been life-changing. John said, "I can speak to Steve like a mate. He's done lots for us and has put our lives 100% on track." Kelly said, "Steve's been trying to help us progress more with our business. He's amazing. He's changed our lives. He's given us a van, got us a new sofa, a shed and cleaned up our garden. He's also got us on Checkatrade and he's paying for John's driving lessons. It's really great that he's given us his time." She said appearing on Rich House, Poor House was definitely an experience and good to see how the other half live. The show is set to air on Channel 5 tomorrow at 9 p.m. The show can also be watched on demand on channel5.com after it airs on TV. Victim brain damaged following attack by yobs. Three yobs who battered a man outside a West Bromwich Wetherspoons have been sentenced. The victim fractured his skull on the pavement during the attack in 2023 and will never be the same again after suffering a brain injury, Wolverhampton Crown Court heard. He had been fighting with Harley Bissell, 21, when Connor Edwards, 27, and Logan Parker, 23, all from Sandwell, spotted the altercation and came to help Bissell. Their assault was captured on CCTV and footage was shown during the trio's sentencing on Wednesday. All three were sentenced for assault, causing grievous bodily harm, with Parker also being sentenced for theft and breaching a suspended sentence. The court heard their victim's life will never be the same again. He is still experiencing pain and is in need of an operation on his head. Judge Simon Ward said, "The court has seen the CCTV, and though I have seen worse attacks during my time as a judge, it still shows how the victim sustained his life-changing injuries. It seems he was chasing you, Bissell, down an alley, and then when you emerged, you were fighting. Then you, Logan and Parker saw this and decided to join in. It was when you teamed up that you crossed the line. The attack did not last that long, and you did not use weapons. But due to the victim hitting his head on the pavement, he became seriously injured. You did not carry on the attack after he had fallen on the floor." In mitigation, the court heard all three were remorseful and pleaded guilty. Bissell, of Campville Crescent, West Bromwich, was given a suspended sentence of 10 months, as he had been defending himself. But Logan and Parker, of no fixed address, were jailed for 19 months and 21 months, respectively. Fears over safety, littering and poor facilities at parks. Residents reluctant to use green spaces unless they are patrolled by police. Concerns over safety, littering and poor facilities are among the reasons why people in the West Midlands are reluctant to use parks and green spaces. West Midlands Combined Authority, WMCA, has launched a major consultation exercise as part of its bid to become the UK's first outdoor region for everyone. Bossy said the exercise is to find out how people feel about their neighbourhoods and what stops them from using parks, green spaces, canals and towpaths in the region. And in a week, almost 150 people have taken part, giving their views on what improvements they want to see and a range of positive, neutral and negative feelings about their areas. One contributor said what stops them using their outdoor spaces is safety concerns and added, "Addressing issues of vandalism and antisocial behaviour would improve the area for them." Another, who had a negative overall feeling about their area, said the thing they liked most about the neighbourhood was the very few last trees are still standing. But they added, "The new developers hate green spaces. Terrible what's happening with the new developments, only cement." One resident who was mostly negative said, "Stop people littering. There is a fantastic crew of volunteers who litter pick, but why do people litter?" Safety was a common theme and many called for measures such as increasing police presence to enhance areas. Others were more positive about their neighbourhoods and put forward suggestions on improving where they live. One said, "Make canal towpaths wider and all weather so walkers and cyclists could use them. Birmingham has more canals than Venice, so it is possible to cycle almost anywhere using towpaths." Another added, "Join up cycle paths instead of them suddenly ending, resulting in unsafe environments with aggressive car drivers." WMCA said, "The West Midlands is home to over 11,000 hectares of parks and green spaces and more than 340 miles of canals and towpaths. Now we want to hear from residents about how these outdoor spaces can become part of everyday life for everyone. We're launching a new public engagement to help shape our ambition for the West Midlands as the UK's first outdoor region for everyone. A connected region where being outdoors, feeling safe and being part of your local community helps make the West Midlands a great place to live, work and visit. At the heart of this work is a simple question. Can better access to safe, attractive and connected outdoor spaces improve well-being, belonging and quality of life so that every resident can see and feel the difference when they step outside their front door? We are especially keen to hear from people and communities who are not currently using our parks, green spaces, streets and canal towpaths. This includes residents facing barriers linked to income, ethnicity, disability, age or where they live. People can take part in the survey by visiting https://outdoor, that's outdoorre, region.commonplace.is/.
Hello, this is Jan Lloyd, reading articles from the Express and Star on Monday the 16th of February. Disorder breaks out after two car crash. Two men were arrested after disorder following a two car collision in Tipton. Police were called to the crash on Upper Church Lane near Lower Comble at just before 2:25 p.m. on Saturday. Officers found two people being treated for injuries which are not believed to be life-changing. Both were taken to hospital for further treatment. Shortly after disorder broke out, and officers detained two men, also seizing a crowbar. A West Midlands police spokesman said, a man, 21, arrested on suspicion of threats to kill and possession of an offensive weapon, has since been bailed. A 56-year-old arrested on suspicion of assault has been given a conditional caution. Raid sees guns and ammunition seized. Police have recovered firearms and ammunition after executing a warrant in Tipton. Officers raided a property on Liso Road in the early hours of yesterday and recovered two rifles as well as ammunition. Two men, aged 35 and 37, and a 39-year-old woman were arrested on suspicion of firearm offences. They have been bailed pending further inquiries. A West Midlands police spokesperson said, anyone with information regarding illegal firearms activity should contact police as a matter of urgency. Alternatively, Crime Stoppers can be contacted 100% anonymously via 0800 555 111. Sounds Project brings City to Life for World Hearing Day by Julian Fisher. An audiology practice is creating a library of well-loved local sounds as part of World Hearing Day. Cathedral Hearing in Lichfield is celebrating the event on March the 3rd. The Sandford Street practice has recorded multiple events, people and locations throughout the city and placed the recordings on its website Sounds of the City. Principal audiologist Laura Evans hopes that creating this catalogue of familiar local sounds will encourage people to reflect on how rich and detailed everyday hearing is and empathise with those who struggle with their hearing. The sound recordings will be used to test out hearing technology at a special open day on Saturday, February the 28th. And the Sounds of the City Library isn't just stopping for World Hearing Day. Further recordings will be added throughout the year to create an engaging and historic list. Laura said, what makes Lichfield so amazing is a combination of its sights, places and importantly its sounds. Those suffering from hearing loss are therefore missing out on a huge chunk of what helps make Lichfield the beautiful city it is. The Cathedral Hearing Sounds of the City project includes recordings of Lichfield Cathedral bells tolling, staff preparing coffee at the Auction Cafe, birdsong at Beacon Park, tourist guide Jono Oates chatting while on one of his walking tours, town crier Adrian Holmes, and bands performing at the Hub at St Mary's. Other sounds will be added throughout the year, including many historic events. Laura added, every sound has a story. The cathedral's bells produce a range of frequencies peppered with strike notes when the bell chimes the hour. When we have many busy coffee shops full of people chatting and machines grinding beans, lots of conflicting noises. To sign up for the free consultation, visit the website or call 01543 319 641. And the article's accompanied by a picture of Lucy Watty and Laura Evans at the launch of the Sounds of the City, one of them wearing earphones and the other one carrying a large fluffy microphone, obviously used for recording the sounds. Proposals for huge HMO at former police training centre are rejected. Sandwell Council has rejected plans to convert a former police training centre into a huge HMO. The empty West Midlands Police Training Centre Windmill House in Windmill Lane, Smethwick, would have been converted into a 76-bed house of multiple occupancy, or HMO, under plans by Kamran Ahmed of Maison Limited. The three-storey building, which dates back to the 1970s, has been used by the region's police force as a training centre and accommodation until it closed last year. The council said ground floor rooms would be greeted with unacceptable views of warehouses, boundary treatments and cycle storage, and called the plans oppressive and substandard. Planners also said the conversion would be unacceptable for neighbours, leading to direct intrusive overlooking and a loss of privacy, and called the building's communal facilities inadequate. The proposal lacks sufficient usable and accessible external amenity space, demonstrates poor pedestrian connectivity from the car park to the rear of the site, and provides inadequate accessibility to cycle storage, the council said. The first floor communal terrace is poorly accessed and fails to provide appropriate defensible space and privacy for adjacent residential units. The siting and scale of the refuse storage to the front of the site would result in unsatisfactory and impractical waste management arrangements. Ramsay sees a much healthier Albion outlook. Albion boss Eric Ramsay is confident his side are better placed to fight against Championship relegation than on his arrival a month ago. The Baggies exited the FA Cup with a 3-1 fourth round defeat at Norwich on Saturday, as Ramsay insisted full focus had to be on the survival dogfight ahead. Ramsay, who marked a month in charge at Hawthorns last week, is now winless in 7 games, and his side have yet to lead under his reign. Albion slumped a place to 20th due to results elsewhere, and now sit 2 places and 2 points above the drop zone. Saturday's visit of Coventry kickstarts a crunch 3-game week, including key clashes against lowly rivals Charlton and Oxford, as under fire Ramsay hunts a first win. I'm sat here relatively comfortable with where we are on the back of the games against Stoke and Birmingham, Ramsay said of last week's successive goalless draws. I felt like no matter the outcome here at Norwich, as long as we felt like we took some steps forward in terms of the depth of the squad, there would be something that we could focus upon. From a positive perspective, and I wouldn't have let Saturday impact on how those 2 games felt, I feel like when we get the group together this week, we'll feel good about the progress we made in terms of performance and clean sheets, and aggression and resilience and that sense of team and fight, which was just huge. And then to be able to add to that sense of competitiveness and players returning and players having minutes in their legs, that's a much healthier picture than I encountered a month ago.
Welcome back to the Express and Star pub quiz. Question 1. News. Which actor has said it is unlikely he will return in the next instalment of the Paddington film franchise? Question 2. Which judge of the Great British Bake Off has announced they are stepping down? Question 3. Sport. Who was the top try scorer at the 2025 Women's Rugby World Cup? Question 4. How many times did Andy Murray reach the Australian Open final? Question 5. Remember when? The British government banned embroidery on women's underwear and nightwear. Salvador Dali published his autobiography. Comedian Billy Connolly was born. And Walt Disney had another cinematic hit with Bambi. Question 6. Lionel Richie had a UK number one single with Hello. Rob Reiner's This Is Spinal Tap was released. The boat race was postponed for a day after Cambridge's boat was damaged, and actress Diana Dawes died. Question 7. Who am I? A politician. I was born in Bath in 1947. I entered Parliament in 1987 as a Conservative MP. I famously accused my political boss, Michael Howard, of having something of the night about him. I have appeared on Strictly Come Dancing and hosted the game show Cleverdix. Question 8. A soprano, I was born in Germany in 1760. I was praised for the precision and clarity of my voice. I married the actor Joseph Lang in 1780, and 2 years later, my sister, Constance, married Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, who had expressed an interest in marrying me. Question 9. Maths impossible puzzles. That's quite a family, said Alan. How old are you? Here's a teaser for you, Greg chuckled. There are 5 of us boys spaced evenly 2 years apart, and I'm the oldest. I'm 1.5 times as old as my youngest brother. How old am I? And question 10. Donuts and eclairs. That's fine for the party. You must have got about 50 in all. Nancy shook her head. Oh, not that many. But I got all that they had. I got as many of each as its price in pence. And the lot came to as many pounds as the number of eclairs and as many pence as the number of doughnuts. How many of each? How's this week's quiz knowledge? Click to the answers to find out. Here are the answers for this week's quiz. Question 1. News. Which actor has said it is unlikely he will return in the next instalment of the Paddington film franchise? Hugh Bonneville. Question 2. Which judge of the Great British Bake Off has announced they are stepping down? Dame Prue Leith. Question 3. Sport. Who was the top try scorer at the 2025 Women's Rugby World Cup? Braxton Sorensen McGee. Question 4. How many times did Andy Murray reach the Australian Open final? 5. Question 5. Remember when? The British government banned embroidery on women's underwear and nightwear. Salvador Dali published his autobiography. Comedian Billy Connolly was born. And Walt Disney had another cinematic hit with Bambi. Question 6. Lionel Richie had a UK number one single with Hello. Rob Reiner's This Is Spinal Tap was released. The boat race was postponed for a day after Cambridge's boat was damaged and actress Diana Dawes died. Question 7. Who am I? A politician. I was born in Bath in 1947. I entered Parliament in 1987 as a Conservative MP. I famously accused my political boss, Michael Howard, of having something of a knight about him. I have appeared on Strictly Come Dancing and hosted the game show Cleverdix. I am Anne Widdicombe. Question 8. A soprano, I was born in Germany in 1760. I was praised for the precision and clarity of my voice. I married the actor Joseph Lang in 1780, and 2 years later, my sister, Constance, married Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, who had expressed an interest in marrying me. I am Maria Aloysia Weber Lang. Question 9. Maths impossible puzzles. That's quite a family, said Alan. How old are you? Here's a teaser for you, Greg chuckled. There are five of us boys spaced evenly 2 years apart, and I'm the oldest. I'm 1.5 times as old as my youngest brother. How old am I? I am 24 years old. And question 10. Donuts and eclairs, that's fine for the party. You must have got about 50 in all. Nancy shook her head. Oh, not that many. But I got all that they had. I got as many of each as its price in pence. And the lot came to as many pounds as the number of eclairs and as many pence as the number of donuts. How many of each? Twelve eclairs and 33 donuts. Thanks for joining me in this week's quiz. I'm Sarah Ann, and I'll be back next time. Bye!
We must now be clear about how your information is used and the steps we take to ensure it is secure. When you asked to receive recordings produced by the Sandwell Talking News, you gave your name and address so that we could send you our memory sticks or CDs. This information is stored in a secure database, and address labels are also stored in a secure location. Having left our premises, the address labels and postal wallets are then under the protection and care of Royal Mail. Your contact details are only used for sending you our memory sticks or CDs, and will never be forwarded to a third party. If you ask us to stop sending Sandwell Talking News to you, your contact details will be deleted from our database and your address labels will be permanently destroyed. We promise and assure you that we take data protection seriously and make every effort to meet the requirements of the Data Protection Act. If your circumstances do change, you move home, change your phone number, or wish to unsubscribe to the Sandwell Talking News, please call the office on 0121 525 4810 or email sandwelltn@gmail.com so that we can make the necessary changes.
Some audio described TV programmes for the next week along with radio programme highlights from Talking News Federation. Search for publications TNF Soundings to hear these directly on their website.
TNF Soundings.
Now for their audio described television programmes for Saturday the 21st of February to Friday the 27th of February, compiled by Richard and read by Lisa. Please note that the TV schedules for the BBC continues to largely focus on the Winter Olympics, and although not audio described, there is a full commentary of the events. Starting with BBC One on Saturday the 14th, you can catch the usual bargain hunt at 11:30 a.m. and the Olympics is on from 1 p.m. to 3:40 p.m. Gladiators is on at 7:15 p.m. and there's a new series of Marion Keyes, The Walsh Sisters at 9:15 p.m. where Anna and Rachel share a cramped Dublin flat but tensions rise after a reckless night out. On BBC Two, it's coverage of the Olympics from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. and again at 3:40 p.m. until 10 p.m. with a brief break at 4:30 for final score. Escape to the Country is sandwiched in between from 1 p.m. to 1:45. On ITV, there's the Six Nations match between England and Ireland. Then follows the Chase Celebrity Special at 5 p.m. Wheel of Fortune at 6 p.m. and a new series of Britain's Got Talent at 7 p.m. with Simon Cowell, Amanda Holden, Alicia Dixon and KCI. The 1% Club is on at 8:25 p.m. Finally, there's It'll Be Alright on the Night with Tom Allen at 10:30 p.m. Channel 4 offers the third of four instalments of Sailing the Shipping Forecast with the Reverend Richard Coles in the Isle of Wight. And The Great Icelandic Swim follows at 7:15 p.m. with Ross swimming through the tail end of a hurricane. Alice Roberts investigates the Etruscans, Trajan's Column and the ingenuity of the ancient Roman aqueducts. The final offering from Channel 4 is the late film Predator at 12:15 a.m, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger as the head of a commando unit trying to survive against a deadly alien enemy. Now for Sunday. BBC One has The Usual Bargain Hunt and Homes Under the Hammer at 11 a.m. and 12 p.m. respectively. The Sunday afternoon film is Spider-Man at 2:50 p.m. and the Asia series continues at 4:45 p.m. There's no Call the Midwife this week. Although not audio described, the BAFTA Awards are on BBC One at 7 p.m. and Episode 3 of Lord of the Flies rounds off BBC One programmes at 9 p.m. when a new beast sighting brings chaos. BBC Two's Olympic coverage of The Last Day starts at 9 a.m. and continues until 4:30 p.m. and again from 7 p.m. until 10 p.m. with the closing ceremony from Verona and the Olympic flame being handed to the French. This is followed at 10 by the comedy drama The Calendar Girls, when two friends, Chris and Annie, decide to raise funds for the local hospital in a rather unusual way after Annie's husband dies of leukaemia. ITV hosts A Love Your Garden at 1:50 p.m. with live commentary of the Six Nations match between France and Italy at 2:20 p.m. Rob Brydon hosts another episode of The Floor at 7 p.m. and a new series, The Lady, starts at 9 p.m. a drama said to be based on real-life events following the appointment of Jane Andrews to the Duchess of York. ITV concludes the evening with the action comedy The Hitman's Bodyguard, starring Ryan Reynolds, Samuel L. Jackson and Gary Oldman. Channel 4 has coverage of the Women's FA Cup match between Liverpool and Everton at 4 p.m, with the match starting at 4:30. Pint-sized pooch Alfie, a red Labrador called Bear, feature in the doghouse at 6:45 p.m. and the quarter-final of the Great Pottery Throwdown follows at 7:45 p.m. where judges Keith and Rich set a surprising second challenge based on body parts. The Secret Genius with Alan Carr follows at 9 p.m. The late film on 4 is Dog, a comedy drama featuring Channing Tatum as a former US Ranger who escorts an army canine across America. On to this week's soap schedules. Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday have EastEnders on BBC One at 7:30 p.m. and Emmerdale and Corrie on ITV One at 8 p.m. and 8:30 p.m. respectively. Thursday has EastEnders at 7:30 on BBC One with Emmerdale at 8 p.m. and Corrie at 8:30 p.m. And finally on Friday, it's Emmerdale at 8 p.m. and Corrie at 8:30 p.m. Now on to Monday, the 23rd of February. BBC One has Escape to the Country at 3 p.m, helping a woman to find peace and tranquility in Northumberland. Silent Witness is on at 9 p.m, where Jack gets involved in a bar fight and Industry follows at 10:40 p.m. after the news. BBC Two has Oceans at 4:15 p.m, following the predatory Humboldt squid invading the sea off Cortez. AI Confidential is on at 9 p.m. with Hannah Fry examining the risks and rewards of the powerful new technology of AI. Small Profits continues at 10 p.m. when Casey comes to Michael's home to meet the prophets. The late film on 2 is Dark Waters, which follows the search for the truth in a legal case connecting a chemical company with farm animal deaths. ITV One has Fletcher's Farm when there's an emergency with a sick ewe and a surprise birthday bash for Lizzie's 40th birthday, followed by part 2 of The Lady. ITV One's late offering is Cold Case Forensics, The Murder of Lynette White at 10:45 p.m. Channel 4 has a new offering for us of Batch from Scratch, Cooking for Less with Joe Swash, helping people in need of advice to stretch their budget. This is followed at 9 p.m. by a new series of Dirty Business, a drama based on real-life investigations into water pollution. This week looking at the effects upon an idyllic hamlet in Oxfordshire. Our final option for Monday is on BBC 4 at 10 p.m. The Joy of AI, looking at how machine scanning simulate, augment and even outperform the human mind. And now for Tuesday. BBC One has week three of MasterChef, the professionals, following four chefs, all hoping to make it into the quarterfinals. Silent Witness continues at 9 p.m. with Nikki trying to help to prove Jack's innocence. Two episodes of Trying follow at 10:40 and 11:05 p.m. A new series of The Great British Menu starts on BBC Two tonight at 7 p.m. as Andy Oliver returns with four chefs from the northwest of England, hoping to provide a banquet-worthy dish to celebrate the British film industry. Alice Roberts hosts Digging for Britain at 8 p.m, looking at some of the finds unearthed by construction of the HS2 rail line. The Zero Line is at 9 p.m, which examines the Russian invasion of Ukraine using testimony from Russian soldiers, revealing the true scale of the horror of the war from the Russian side and the tactics employed by the Russian army to maintain control. ITV1 has the Martin Lewis Money Show at 7:15 p.m, which, whilst not audio described, may be of interest in a show discussing the energy price cap. The Summit with Ben Shepherd continues at 9 p.m, when the New Zealand terrain and brutal vote-offs reduces the number of contestants to 9. After the news, the heat is on at 10:45, in which a group of ambitious chefs compete for a job in Barcelona with Jean-Christophe Novelli. Finally, Channel 4 focuses on short trips to city destinations in Bargain Holiday Secrets at 8 p.m, followed by part 2 of Dirty Business, examining water quality failings in Oxfordshire. Two repeated episodes of Gogglebox follow at 10:05 and 11:05 p.m. And on to Wednesday. The Repair Shop is on BBC One at 8 p.m, with a team helping to repair an engagement ring, a beer pump, and a pair of figures by artist Leonard McComb. MasterChef, The Professionals, continues at 9 p.m, with two contestants preparing a bavette steak and two making falafel, tomato and flatbread salad. BBC Two continues The Great British Menu at 7 p.m, with the chefs from the northwest serving up their choice of main course dishes. Angela Scanlon presents Your Home Made Perfect at 8 p.m, using virtual reality to demonstrate property transformations. Finally, there's a new series of the comedy We Might Regret This at 10 p.m. ITV starts a new series called The Stolen Girl, a drama based on the novel Playday by Alex Dahl. When Elisa Blix goes to collect her daughter from a sleepover, she discovers that her child is missing. Cold Case Forensics follows the case of Rachel Nichol at 11:40 p.m. Channel 4's offering sees Kirsty and Phil in Edinburgh in Love It or List It at 8 p.m, followed by the conclusion of Dirty Business at 9 p.m. At 10:05 p.m, Channel 4 presents First Dates, following Kathleen, a 64-year-old singer, and holiday park performer Edward, looking for their soulmates. Our options for Thursday. On BBC One, Dragon's Den continues at 8 p.m, featuring building entrepreneurs, pitching dating apps, gut-friendly ferments, and build-it-yourself headphone kits for kids. Episode 5 of The Apprentice follows at 9 p.m, with the contestants selling flowers and creating colourful floral installations. BBC Two has The Great British Menu at 6 p.m, and today the chefs present their complete menus for judging. At 9 p.m, Murder Case, the hunt for Arlene Fraser's killer, investigating the disappearance of a mother from her home in Elgin. BBC Two rounds off the evening at 10 p.m. with The Apprentice, Unfinished Business. ITV One has Dickinson's Real Deal at 2 p.m, and at 9 p.m. has Murder on a Knife Edge, True Crime Presents, as Wayne Coventry seeks romance after 18 years in a toxic relationship. Channel 4 sees the final outing of George Clark's Building Home at 8 p.m, helping a couple restore a Victorian cottage in Radcliffe-on-Trent in Nottinghamshire. The Dunblane Tapes follow at 9 p.m. The story of a grassroots campaign to ban private handguns in the UK after the shooting in 1996. Two episodes of 24 Hours in A&E at 10:30 p.m. and at 11:35 p.m. round off the evening on 4. And finally, Friday. BBC One has Homes Under the Hammer at 11:15 a.m. and Escape to the Country at 2:45 p.m. Early evening begins with MasterChef The Professionals at 7:30 p.m. and it's quarterfinals time and the chefs must make a dish using chicken offcuts in just 70 minutes. They then have to cook a two-course menu for the judges and some renowned food writers and critics. Death in Paradise is at 9 p.m. and a touring company is in town in St. Marie, but death inevitably follows. BBC Two presents The Wild Gardener at 7 p.m. following cameraman Colin Stratford Johnson returning to his native island. A new series of Big Cats 24/7 returns at 9 p.m. in which the filmmakers return to Botswana. ITV1 sees Tom Allen providing another selection of unseen outtakes and bloopers in It'll Be Alright on the Night at 7:30 p.m. Bradley Walsh presents Beat the Chasers at 9 p.m. and at 10:45 is Devil in Disguise. John Wayne's Gacy. As a blizzard hits Chicago, Gacy's survivors are located. Finally, Channel 4 has Car SOS at 12:10 p.m. and Find It, Fix It, Flog It at 1:10 p.m. as Henry and Simon try to make more money by upcycling various objects. In the evening at 8 p.m. there's How to Sleep Better, where Denise Van Outen investigates why the British are a nation of bad sleepers. Gogglebox is on at 9 p.m. and the film Scream is your late night option starting at 12:10 a.m. That concludes our options for the week ahead. I hope you find something of interest.
Here are the radio listings for the 7 days beginning Saturday, the 21st of February, compiled by Wendy and read by Gilly. Starting with Saturday, 21st of February. Alan Rickman stars in an adaptation from 1983 of Patrick Hamilton's play Rope, in which two arrogant university students think they've committed the perfect murder. It's on Radio 4 Extra at 6 a.m, 11 a.m. and 5 p.m. Secrets and Lies, Double Exposure is a documentary drama about photographer Ernest Withers, who captured the story of the civil rights movement across the USA, while at the same time working for the FBI. Radio 4 at 3 p.m. I Remember Dame Gladys Cooper is a 1969 programme in which West End and Hollywood actor Gladys Cooper recalled her exciting career from meeting Ellen Terry to friendships with Noel Coward, J.M. Barrie and Peter Ustinov. It's on Radio 4 Extra at 10 a.m, 3 p.m. and 9 p.m. Moving on to Sunday, 22nd of February. The castaway in Desert Island Discs is Rula Khalaf, the first female editor of the Financial Times, on Radio 4 at 10 a.m. While in an archive edition from 1987, Michael Parkinson interviews Kenneth Williams on Radio 4 Extra at 6 a.m. This is part of 6 hours of programmes about Kenneth Williams to mark the 100th anniversary of his birth, which can be heard from 6 a.m. to 12 noon, then all repeated from 12 to 6 p.m. and again from 6 p.m. to midnight, all on Radio 4 Extra. Someone Else's Problem, Exporting the Housing Crisis, asks what happens when homeless families from London are rehoused in the North East, on Radio 4 at 1:30 p.m. In The Extractor, Israel's foremost search and rescue specialist, Hilik Magnus, discusses his work on Radio 4 at 7:15 p.m. Turning now to those programmes which are broadcast at the same time every day from Monday to Friday. In The Ancient Ark, Joanna Pinnock
links birds and animals, including the wolf, the boar, and the mad March hare, to Britain's ancient cultures, on Radio 4 Extra at 9:30 a.m. every day this week. Breaking Point is an adaptation of Dick Francis's 1964 thriller novel, Nerve, on Radio 4 Extra at 6 a.m., 11 a.m. and 5 p.m. Monday to Friday. The book of the week is Unspeakable, Survival and Transformation After Trauma, in which leading forensic psychiatrist Gwen Adshead reads from her book, reflecting on her work with the survivors of trauma. That's on Radio 4 at 11:45 a.m. each day this week. Anybody Can Do Anything is a reading of Betty MacDonald's hilarious account of survival during the Depression, on Radio 4 Extra at 8:30 a.m., 1:30 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. Monday to Friday. More comedy, and Ladies of Letters Go Global is Series 6 of the comedy, starring the late Patricia Routledge and Prunella Scales, at 8:45 a.m., 1:45 p.m. and 7:45 p.m. every day this week. The composer of the week is the American musician Amy Beach, in brackets 1867 to 1944, on Radio 3 at 4 p.m. Monday to Friday. The essay Full Moon on Progress Street has profiles of five black female musicians, beginning on Monday with Sarah Vaughan, on Radio 3 at 9:45 p.m. on each day this week. The book at bedtime is Salt by Catherine Keane, a love story based on the lives of the author's great-grandparents, on Radio 4 at 10:45 p.m. Monday to Friday. Now, here are some individual programmes to listen to through the week, starting with Monday, the 23rd of February. In Thoroughly Modest Molly, Bernard Cribbins celebrates comedy writer Molly Millist, who wrote scripts for Kenneth Horne's radio shows, yet remained in the background, living a double life as a member of the Salvation Army. Radio 4 at 10:30 a.m. and 4:30 p.m. Mrs. Lowry and Son is a biographical work from 2012, exploring the relationship between the artist L.S. Lowry and his mother, on Radio 4 Extra at 3 p.m. and 9 p.m. There's an episode of the culinary panel show, The Kitchen Cabinet, on Radio 4 at 4:30 p.m. In the series How Did We Get Here?, this week's episode looks at the period from the 19th century to the First World War, on Radio 4 at 8 p.m. Some suggestions for Tuesday, the 24th of February. A new series of History's Heroes begins with Cardinal Sin and the Bandit Radio, the story of an archbishop in the Philippines who took to the airwaves and called for his people to rise up against a dictatorship. It's on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. Angela Baddeley and John Gielgud star in a production from 1957 of Terence Rattigan's play The Browning Version, on Radio 4 Extra at 3 p.m. and 9 p.m. Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, the Choral Symphony, is the subject of Between the Ears, Odes to Joy, on Radio 4 at 4 p.m. In Touch brings us news, views and information for people who are blind or partially sighted, presented as usual by Peter White, on Radio 4 at 8:40 p.m. Moving on to Wednesday, 25th of February. Today's drama is The People's Crusade, a story for Britain. After a landslide win for a new county council, Marianne and the community must start getting used to the new normal and decide where their allegiances lie, on Radio 4 at 2:15 p.m. A new series of The Law Show, a weekly guide to law and the legal decisions that have a bearing on everyone in the UK, begins on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. Choral Evensong is on Radio 3 at 3 p.m. Derek Jacobi stars in a 1981 dramatisation of James Hilton's 1933 novel Lost Horizons. On Radio 4 Extra at 3 p.m. and 9 p.m. and continuing tomorrow and Friday at the same times. In the series The Decisions That Made Me, the subject is upholsterer and star of the repair shop, Sonaz Nuranveri, who talks about defying her parents' expectations and following her own instincts in choosing a career. Radio 4 at 8:45 p.m. Then on Thursday, 26th of February, Great Lives, this week, celebrates the legacy of London-born Labour politician Tony Benn on Radio 4 Extra at 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. In Alexei Sayle's Strangers on a Train, the comedian hears from fellow passengers travelling from Edinburgh to Aberdeen on Radio 4 Extra at 8 a.m., 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. Series 8 of Ballylennon begins today, the comedy set in a sleepy village in 1960s County Donegal. It's on Radio 4 Extra at 2:30 p.m. and 8:30 p.m. Open Country this week visits the Savernack Forest in Wiltshire, an ancient hunting ground with hundreds of veteran trees, on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. In Radical, Amal Rajan and his guests offer their analysis of the biggest news stories of the week on Radio 4 at 11 p.m. And so to Friday the 27th of February. Pepys the Musician tells the story of post-diary Samuel Pepys on Radio 4 Extra at 10:30 a.m. and 4:30 p.m. Rare Earth begins a new series with Our Oceanic Future, reporting from the world's biggest ocean science conference on Radio 4 at 12:04 p.m. There's another vintage episode of Steptoe and Son from 1971 on Radio 4 Extra at 7:30 a.m., 12:30 p.m. and 6:30 p.m. And finally, Friday night is Music Night, anticipates St. David's Day with works by Welsh composers and others who have been inspired by Wales. It's on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. Enjoy your listening week.
TNS Soundings.
Hello, this is Trevor reading articles from the Express and Star from Tuesday, the 17th of February. Woman's beloved assistance dog aims to be Star of Crufts. Ignatius helps owner with everyday tasks such as emptying the washing machine. This article is by Matt Wright. A railway worker from Tipton, whose assistance dog gets her through the day both at home and at work, will be looking for further success when they return to Crufts together next month. Lily Abbott, age 44, is an accessibility delivery manager with West Midlands and London Northwestern Railway, and will be taking 4-year-old Ignatius to the world's largest dog show next month for a third time. Ignatius is a miniature long-haired Dachshund and is believed to be the first of his breed to qualify for an assistance dog through the charity Dog AID. He helps Mrs. Abbott with everyday tasks such as emptying the washing machine, helping her to dress and undress, and pick things dropped on the floor. Although his small size means working light switches are a leap too far. Ignatius will be competing in the obedience final at Crufts in his group, Dachtastic, as well as being part of the Good Citizens Dog Training Scheme display team. Mrs. Abbott said he is absolutely full of sass. There is so much attitude in that tiny body, it is unbelievable, and he does literally think the world is going to Crufts to see him. This will be his second year doing the Good Citizen display and his second year doing the obedience final. Although the sausages in the obedience final are more there for the entertainment than anything else, but he has a lot of personality, and he also has a renowned move were in the bed race, they will all have to run to their beds and they humps his bed into the main arena non-stop. You can imagine how I have to try and drag him across the main arena while he's doing that, and everyone finds it very funny. Ignatius also accompanies Mrs. Abbott to work, which includes being part of the train's crew, meaning he travels with her from as far as Liverpool to London Euston. He also came first in his puppy class at Crufts when he was youngster. And Mrs. Abbott, who has been involved in dog sport for 20 years, can't wait to take him back to Birmingham. She said, "I've been involved with Crufts for many years and he absolutely adores the competitions. He just thinks it's the best thing. The moment he is performing, the world is there to see him. Nobody else, just purely him, and his sass truly comes out. Personally, I adore being able to see all the dogs and all the different breeds. I'm like a little girl in a sweet shop, and I love that it's such a family show." Crufts, run by the Kennel Club, is being held from March the 5th to the 8th at the NEC Birmingham. Police objecting to reopening of pub following horrifying baton attack. Westminster police have objected to plans for a West Bromwich pub to reopen after being stripped of its licence last year. Sandwell Council shut down the Prince of Wales in West Bromwich High Street after a horrifying baton attack involving unlicensed store staff and patrons in November last year. In December, the local authority's licensing committee stripped 69-year-old Rajinder Singh, who has run the pub for more than two decades, of his licence over the horrible incident, saying serious crime and disorder had taken place. An application for a new licence to reopen the West Bromwich pub was then made by Balbinder Singh, which led to the objections from police as well as West Midlands Fire Service. West Midlands Police said it was concerned by the quick turnaround following the revoking of the licence and intention to run the business in a similar way as before. Footage of the incident and the body cam of officers attending the incident that triggered the summary review show patrons of the venue watching the incident, and at no point did any patron attempt to ring the police or ambulance services or speak to officers at the scene. To give full details of what had happened, during the officers' attendance on site, customers carry on as normal and are clearly unfazed that a weapon has been used on customers both inside and outside of the premises. As such, it causes West Midlands Police serious concerns that the premises is likely to operate in a very similar way to previously, with the same business model and attracting the same crowd who appeared unfazed by the disorder that took place there previously, and who were unwilling to do the right thing in the situation. Evidence given at the full review hearing also established that the premises had previous incidents of concern, suggesting a pattern of fights and crimes linked to the operation of the premises. West Midlands Fire Service also objected to the new licence, saying there were several issues with the pub, including defective emergency lighting, and no evidence its fire detection system or alarms had been tested or maintained. There was also no fire risk assessment in place for the pub, the fire service said. The new application includes permission to open from 9 a.m. to 3 a.m. every day, with alcohol sold until 2:30 a.m. The licence would also include permission to play live and recorded music until the same time. Why half-term week should not be a siege? Educationalist weighs in on the pressures to study for exams. This article is by Roshan Doog. This week is half-term week. For many families, that means one dominant theme: mock exams, revision schedules, and preparation for the real exams in June. GCSEs and A-levels loom large. Bedrooms become study zones. Conversations tighten around grades and predicted outcomes. I spent much of my life in education, and I am not anti-exam. Qualifications matter. They open doors, they provide structure and opportunity. But I've become increasingly concerned about the overt emphasis placed on measurable attainment and the anxiety that inevitably follows. Of course I believe in standards. I believe in rigour. I believe that qualifications can transform lives. But I'm convinced that we have crossed the line, that our fixation with measurable attainment has tipped into something unhealthy, even ideological. We say we are educating, often we are simply training for assessment. Decades ago, at an FE college not far from Wolverhampton, I saw the system reveal itself with startling clarity. I was teaching Seamus Heaney to an A-level class. Specification required students to study a prescribed selection from four collections. Fair enough. But literature is not a rotation pack, so I briefly widened the lens. I introduced them to Heaney beyond the anthology. The development of his voice, the politics beneath the pastoral and the mythical undercurrents, the spiritual unease. In other words, I treated him as a human being rather than an exam commodity. I was called into a meeting. I was formally reprimanded by my line manager. The charge, teaching beyond the required poems. The fear that exposing students to Heaney's wider body of work might distract them from what actually be examined. Read that again. Intellectual breadth, wider reading, was framed as a risk. Curiosity was treated as inefficiency. Depth was seen as deviation. The message was clear. Stick to the four collections. Follow the scheme of work. Do not stray. I left that meeting not angry, but troubled, because what was really being defended was not student welfare, but institutional performance. Results drive league tables drive funding, recruitment, reputation, and so the system quality rewards compliance over courage. We talk endlessly about inspiring young minds and then confine them to bullet points. During half term, the machine accelerates. Students rehearse model answers like scripts. They memorise examiner-friendly phrases. They learn how to hit the assessment objectives. And when technique eclipses that, we are no longer educating, we are manufacturing. As a government policy advisor, I see the fallout. Perfectly capable teenagers interpreting a market grade as a referendum on their intelligence. 16-year-olds convinced that one bad week will permanently derail their lives. That is not academic ambition, that is anxiety institutionalised. Perhaps my resistance to the culture is rooted in something personal. My Hindu parents never pressurised me academically. Not once did they tell me I wasn't good enough. Not once did they compare me to others. Education was valued deeply, but love was not conditional on performance. Because of that, I pursued achievements without fear. I worked hard because I wanted to, not because I was terrified of falling short. I did well academically, and I remained emotionally intact. Sadly, too many young people today are not afforded that luxury. The tragedy is that the qualities that actually determine long-term success, resilience, adaptability, intellectual independence, cannot be easily plotted on a spreadsheet. So they are sidelined. We measure what is convenient, not what is profound. Exams in June matter. Preparation during half term matters. But when education becomes high stakes treadmill from which students feel they cannot step off, we should pause. If a teacher can be reprimanded for teaching the wider poetry of Seamus Heaney, then we have to ask what we truly value. Are we cultivating thinkers or simply efficient candidates? Grades are useful, but they are not sacred. They measure performance under time conditions. They do not measure character, critical thinking skills, or imagination. And if we continue to pretend they do, we should not be surprised when stress becomes the defining feature of adolescence. So this week should not feel like a siege. Remember that real education should enlarge the mind, not shrink it to fit the schemes of work, assessment objectives, and exam papers. Roshan Doog is an educationalist.
That's it for the news this week. So thank you to Trevor and all the other readers. So coming up are one or two other items, the first of which is rather unusual, and it's a pity I can't bring this to you in stereo, as it was recorded by Philip Francis Anderson, somebody I came across on an email list, who's producing a series of podcasts called Driving Blind. So what we're going to hear is the trailer for that series, and I hope those of you who can get podcasts decide to subscribe to this. But here's Philip's 5-minute introduction to the series, and I do hope that he allows us to use the rest of the series in due course.
For as long as I can remember, I've had the same dream. I'm seated behind the wheel of a car. Night road, open motorway, the world unfolding in quiet formation. As the junction approaches, the vehicle slows. Calmly, precisely, and comes to a complete standstill. No alarm, just arrival. Perhaps it's no surprise, cars fascinated me from childhood, even as my own world was shaped by sight loss at an early age. Part of that fascination began with my cousin, the one who introduced me to the language of driving. He showed me the steering wheel, the indicators, the gears, the pedals, and helped me understand how everything worked together. I was only 7 when we lost him to a tragic road accident, a sudden moment on the road that no one could have foreseen. Too young to grasp the permanence of it, but not too young to remember what he had given me. And that learning continued. On my journeys to and from boarding school in the 1970s, my driver would let me act as his gear operator, so that by the time I was 10, I could tell exactly when a gear needed changing, simply by listening to the engine. It never felt extraordinary. It was just how I learned to move through the world, with people often remarking how I navigate as though I have full sight. But what guides me is not vision, but patterns, memory, attention, trust.
Welcome aboard this Chiltern Railway service to Birmingham Moor Street.
For most of my life, that trust has lived within me, in my senses, in the maps my brain builds instinctively each day.
Don't touch the steering wheel or pedals during your ride.
But what happens when that trust is asked to move beyond the self?
Just give us 1 minute to cover a few riding tips.
3 years ago, when I was first confronted by the idea of an autonomous car, my answer was immediate. No. Driving for me was never about transport. It was union. Human and machine responding as one. Yet today, something has shifted. Because these vehicles are no longer the language of science fiction. They are here. And very real. And for the first time, I find myself wondering, am I surrendering to control or discovering a new kind of freedom?
When the sounds of electric cars are driven by intelligent algorithms, endless possibilities are within reach.
I'm Philip Anderson, and this is Driving Blind, a short series exploring trust, autonomy, perception, and the ever-changing relationship between humans and machines that help us navigate the world. And perhaps now is the ideal time to follow where that dream was leading. That was Driving Blind, the trailer, by Philip Francis Anderson. For more information on this series, go to talkingpoint.site. Driving Blind is the property of Philip Francis Anderson and is copyright. It is illegal to download and distribute copies of this audio recording without the express permission of the copyright owner. For permissions, email info@talkingpoint.site.
TNF Soundings.
features from across the UK.
Hello, this is Amanda with an article written by Fiona, inspired by this year's Winter Paralympics being held in Italy in March. Tampa, Florida resident Griffin Pinko was just 12 years old when he realised something wasn't right. While playing baseball, he suddenly struggled to see the ball flying across the outfield. At first, he chalked it up to poor night vision. But that changed with a life-altering diagnosis. Retinitis pigmentosa, a retinal degenerative disease that gradually impacts vision and ultimately leads to blindness. While attending university in 2013, Griffin turned his diagnosis into a movement that is transforming lives, the Foreseeable Future Foundation. Our focus is improving the lives of VIPs, visually impaired people, he explained. Sports and recreation can change lives. They build confidence, independence, and a sense of belonging. Griffin is right, of course, as history has shown. This year, the world will turn its attention to the 2026 Paralympic Winter Games being held in Milan, Italy, from March 6th to the 15th. There are currently 29 Paralympic sports sanctioned by the International Paralympic Committee, including categories for visual impairment, physical impairment, and intellectual impairment. The games this year are referred to as Milano Cortina 2026 because they are jointly hosted by the city of Milan and the mountain resort town of Cortina d'Ampezzo. According to the National Paralympic Heritage Trust website, sport for people who are blind or partially sighted or disabled has a long history going back over 100 years, and the first sport clubs for the deaf were already in existence in 1888 in Berlin. It is said that Spain founded blind football in the 1920s and Austria founded goalball in the 1940s, a sport developed specifically for people with sight loss rather than an adapted version of an existing sport. It was not until after World War II, however, that goalball and other disability-friendly sports were widely introduced. The purpose of VI sport at that time was to assist rehabilitation of the large number of war veterans and civilians who had been injured during wartime. In 1944, at the request of the British government, Dr. Ludwig Gutmann opened a spinal injury centre at the Stoke Mandeville Hospital in Aylesbury, and he found sport useful in motivating patients. In time, rehabilitation sport evolved to recreational sport and then to competitive sport. In 1948, the Stoke Mandeville Games were organised for the first time as a sports competition for wheelchair athletes. They featured 16 individuals, 14 men and 2 women, competing in para-archery. The Stoke Mandeville Games later became the Paralympic Games, which first took place in Rome, Italy, in 1960, featuring 400 athletes from 23 countries. Since then, they have taken place every 4 years. This was the origin of what evolved into the modern Paralympic Games, which today attracts over 4,400 athletes with physical, visual, and intellectual impairments. Finally, the word Paralympic derives from the Greek preposition para, beside or alongside, and the word Olympic. Its meaning is that Paralympics are the parallel games to the Olympics and illustrates how the two movements exist side by side. If you want to know more about the 2026 Winter Paralympic Games, you can find lots more information online. You can find the official website by entering paralympic.org.uk/Milano-Cortina-2026.
I'll be in match report.
Mohamed Touré continued his stunning start to life on loan at Norwich City as his side secured a 3-1 FA Cup win over West Bromwich Albion. The Australian striker, who signed from Danish club Randers a fortnight ago, made it 5 goals in 3 appearances in the space of a week, heading in the 3rd goal in added time. The Baggies showed some of their recent improved form with a second-half fight back as Josh Madger equalised, but Ben Crisine scored his 2nd goal against them this season to edge the Canaries back in front. Norwich had looked to be in full control at half-time, as new signing Paris Magoma, making his first start, capped a sparkling performance with a headed goal to give his side the lead. With top goal scorer Jovan Mukama out following foot surgery and Josh Sargent still in limbo after refusing to play last month, Canaries fans might have wondered who would provide the goals to put them into the 5th round of the Cup. Their questions were answered emphatically, with Magoma opening his account with a smart header after Harry Darling nodded Jacob Wright's corner back across goal in the first half, with Josh Griffiths denying Matthias Fitzgarten 3 times in the opening 45 minutes, the Canaries put on a show which had their fans chanting about sexy football. Their performance was a far cry from October, when a 1-0 loss to the Baggies in the league at Carrow Road began a run of 6 consecutive defeats. Things have improved in recent weeks, but the Baggies have also shown signs of ending a dismal spell, and they saw Madger twice tuck the ball away, however, the first was ruled offside. West Brom boss Eric Ramsey replaced the injured Griffiths with the side's usual number one, Max O'Leary, at half-time, who brilliantly denied Wright after Oscar Squarto's barnstorming run took him 3/4 of the length of the field. The visitors exerted control as the Norwich momentum waned and Madger dashed onto Ousmane Diakite's through ball and expertly chipped goalkeeper Daniel Grimshaw to level the score. Norwich had been contrastingly average in the second half, but they pieced together another flowing move with 8 minutes left to reclaim the lead. Wright fed Ben Slimane and he moved it on to fellow substitute Crisine, who arrowed the ball into the bottom corner. The goal took the wind out of Albion and Slimane conjured up a 3rd goal in added time, juggling the ball and then headed it into the path of Touré. The striker, who opened his account on debut against Blackburn last week before adding a hat-trick in midweek against Oxford United, finished with a close-range header. Eric Ramsey said, "I'm really disappointed to lose the game, particularly given how the second half went and how we felt that we grew into the game and played with some real authority for a large portion of that second half. I felt strongly before that game that, irrespective of the outcome, we had to come out feeling positive across a number of other elements, and there were strong performances from young players, Ollie Bostock, Harry Whitewell, and from Hindo Mustafa. And we had to feel that we were nudging players towards the 90 minutes fit. The guys that haven't been able to hit 90 minutes all that regularly so far this season, the fact we've done that across the board is pleasing. We weren't happy with the first half performance. There wasn't the level of aggression and competitiveness that we would have expected, and we lacked control on the ball. That was entirely different in the second half."
TNF Soundings.
And next we catch up with Charlotte from Guide Dogs and the latest news about Buster.
Hello, this is Charlotte from Guide Dogs. Today I'm back with, sadly, your final update on Buster's training. Due to Buster's stealing behaviours, it was decided by our panel of experts that he is not suitable to continue his role in training to be a guide dog. This decision was based on the fact that the behaviour is not easy to control, as it tends to happen when he is by himself or off-lead on a free run, and can have very serious consequences. His recent surgery could have been fatal, and the items that he is most likely to steal are found in every home, socks and tea towels being his favourites. Even though we are working on improving this behaviour, We feel that the behaviour is quite ingrained, as he's been doing this since he was a young puppy, and we wouldn't want to put him at any risk or be a source of stress and worry for a future guide dog owner. For now, Buster has remained at his fosterer's, where he will await a decision on rehoming. Several people have put in an application to rehome Buster, so our rehoming officer will interview them in the following weeks. Buster continues to recover well from his surgery and has now been allowed to have some off-lead exercise, which is a great relief after 4 weeks of bed rest. He seems to be enjoying pet dog life and has had no further episodes of stealing since his surgery. As Buster has now been withdrawn from training, I have been allocated a new dog who is due to come in to training next week. Buttons is a lovely laid-back yellow Labrador cross golden retriever and is coming with no known issues aside from car sickness, which he has struggled with his whole life. For that reason, he will need an adaptive training pathway, especially in the early days. I will be placing Buttons with a fosterer who can accommodate a work-from-home setup for Buttons while we test out how he will be travelling in her car and then later in my van. If the car sickness persists, I will be able to work Buttons from the fosterer's house for most of his training. We do have guide dog owners on our list who very rarely travel in cars, but this would be a matching implication. Thankfully, Buster has already been tested on the train and on the bus, and he is fine on both. Some dogs do grow out of car sickness or manage with shorter journeys, and I'm hoping this will be the case for Buttons. I will continue these updates following Buttons throughout his training. Thank you very much, and I'll update you again in a month's time.
TNF Soundings.
Thank you to all our Sandwell volunteers who've read the Express and Star articles for us this week. Mia, Jan, who has covered for Janet as well, so she's done 2 days worth. Rachel, Linda and Trevor. Thanks to Ray for putting everything together and to Tony and Gavin for putting everything on USB sticks and CDs and sending it out in the post. I'd also like to welcome any new listeners that we have this week. Have a lovely week, everyone.
Thank you, Pam, and thank you for the thank yous. And hope you've enjoyed listening this week. Do get the pen drives back to us if you're a postal listener as soon as you can. Meanwhile, coming up for postal listeners with this week's edition of In Touch, which is quite a mixed bag. But for now, I have to sign off. Bye-bye for now, and we'll be with you next week.
To use our talk phone service to listen to Sandwell Talking News or leave us a message, phone 0121 699 6696. If you are using a landline in the 0121 area, then just dial 699 6696.